India that the assistance of Arab states for Palestine had decreased by as much as 81.6%. The Al Alam television channel announced that Arab countries had helped $38.1 million from January to August of 2020, while this figure stood at $198.3 million in previous year 2019. The Saudi regime's help to the Palestinians only amounted to $30 million in the first 8 months of 2020, whereas the same figure was $130 million in 2019. For sure, the Saudis, Emiratis, Bahrainis are partners in crime with the Zionist regime. What adds salt to injury to the Palestinians is the fact that the United Nations, the UN Security Council and other international bodies have had no role in alleviating the pain of the Palestinians, despite their vociferous claims of human rights, rights of women and children, and so on. This is while if a Jewish person's property is lost or an incident takes place for a Jew somewhere in the world, these same international bodies, including the United Nations, will express sympathy for them. Brutal expulsion of the Palestinian people of Yemen and other Muslim lands are not included in the charter of these so-called international organizations. For more than 70 years, the Israeli regime has committed the most heinous crimes in history against Palestinians. But the United Nations has kept silent. Its affiliated bodies have tacitly approved these Israeli crimes. And even if they have issued resolutions against the Zionist regime, these resolutions have never been binding. They have been mere scraps of paper and a cause of mockery by Israel as it has been emboldened to carry on with its crimes. The United States, Israel's principal backer, has used its power of veto at the United Nations to back up the Zionist regime. And the Zionist regime has continued with its nefarious crimes against humanity. Like the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has emphasized the Quranic principle of resistance, saying this is the only way to deter Israel and to support the Palestinian cause. Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The main recommendation is the continuation of the struggle and expansion of the arena of jihad in all Palestinian territories. And no doubt, the Zionist virus will not last, and with the efforts, faith and courage of all Muslims, it will be uprooted and obliterated from this region."
We get people.
U.S. support for Israel.
The U.S. has been giving the Israeli regime unwavering support from the get-go. Thus, Israel has no greater friend than the United States today. The U.S. has given Tel Aviv billions of dollars in foreign military aid to remain a most strategic ally to the Zionist regime. Here's how they spend the money. Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javan Mardi. In this episode, we will delve into decades of US abetment of Israel's brutal policies, not just against its neighbors, but across the region and even the rest of the world. and more importantly, whether or not that support is undergoing any shifts today. Thank you for watching We the People.
As a young girl visiting Palestine to see my grandparents and extended family, I watched as my mother had to go to dehumanizing checkpoints. I remember shaking with fear when checkpoints appeared in the small village of Beth Orel Foka, tanks and guns everywhere.
Washington's closeness to Tel Aviv has helped strengthen the U.S. presence in the West Asian region. The United States has stored military equipment in Israel since the early 1990s. Yet the unbreakable bond between Israel and the U.S. runs deeper than military aids and treaties.
Anyone who wants to contribute to the cause, anyone who wants to provide funds or any other kind of help is welcome. We love our friends, and we don't see why some people should feel uneasy about taking assistance or money from this or that friend.
The so-called State of Israel was established by the Israeli Declaration of Independence on 14th of May 1948. Israel was officially declared a state, setting off on a path to brutality towards the occupied lands, neighboring countries, and beyond. Today, Tel Aviv's atrocities have been acknowledged by almost every state in the world. Our first guest is Dr. Rabab Abdulhadi, a senior scholar and the director of Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies at San Francisco University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you. Dr. Abdulhadi, first of all, how do you evaluate the U.S.-Israel relations throughout history and the unwavering support Washington has offered to Tel Aviv?
Historically, the United States has supported Israel. Since actually the foundation of the State of Israel in 1948, more successive U.S. administrations have increased support as they went along until the latest president, Trump, has actually not only supported Israel but went along unconditionally with every aspect of its colonialist, racist, and apartheid policies. So this has been going on and it has gotten to a very alarming situation right now.
Many thanks for your insight, Dr. Abdulhadi.
The U.S. support for Israel does not only involve the U.S. government itself. A glance at the history of the West's support for the Israeli regime shows that the number of Christian evangelicals backing the Zionist agenda stands way above the actual Jews. Christian Zionism is a phenomenon of the past and the present, a false ancient obsession that still today gets to play a significant role in world politics, particularly inside establishments of superpowers such as the United Kingdom and the United States.
Christians have directly brought over 750,000 Jews to Israel. That it started with the Soviet or the Russian Jews. It continued with Ethiopian Jews, where we brought most of the Ethiopians. It continued with some of these lost tribes of B'nai Menashe from India. But today, we bring from 28 countries.
But making Jews go to lands that belong to Palestinians comes with a high cost for humanity. How can the Christian Zionists' ancient prophecies and their combination with power in Washington be justified, considering its impact on the reality of people's lives today? Abbas Hamida is with us to discuss that. He's a Palestinian activist and commentator. He's also the co-founder of Al-Awda, the Palestine Right to Return Coalition. Hello and welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Mr. Hamida, what is on the evangelicals' agenda?
The Christian Zionists have an agenda, you know, in occupied Palestine, more so probably than the Jewish Zionists. I mean, in my opinion, they're just being used. So they have that same colonial settler mentality where we see in Palestine, for example, Jews coming from anywhere around the world, in particular Europe, they come and build these illegal outposts, okay? They build these houses on the mountaintops right across the street from the Palestinian people. You know, these people are extremely delusioned. They believe in a fanatical style, an ISIS style, if you will, of religion.
Thanks for your insights. Stay with us.
Evangelicals began cultivating ties with Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu during his first stint as prime minister in the 1990s. Today, the Israeli premier is the evangelicals' rock star. But not all Israelis have that sense of trendline in the U.S. Instead, some fear the Christian Zionists' true missionary agenda, converting them.
I believe that evangelicals support Israel because they connect Israel to their faith. Their Bible is a Jewish Bible. Their Messiah is a Jewish Messiah. And it's a connection. It's a DNA that goes back to Sunday school and to their very being. It's a love affair. It's a romance with a nation that is connected to heaven and earth.
That has made Israelis, even those residing on illegal settlements, view evangelists as a threat to Jews, though the Christians may have just been dispatched to help them harvest grapes at their vineyards on the occupied Palestinian territories. So, how is the love-hate relationship going?
Christian Zionists are very much committed to the preservation of Israeli colonialism, racism, and apartheid, because they actually also have this belief that if they bring about the power of Israel, Israel is going to fall apart, and by the Israel's falling apart, that's going to bring up the Messiah. So actually they are interested. They are engaged and invested in the destruction of the Jewish people, if you will, inside Israel. The Zionists, the Jewish Zionist lobby and non-Jewish, because it is not only Jews, and there are many, many Jews, growing number of Jews, who stand on the side of justice in for Palestine and join hand in hand with Palestinians in the struggle for justice for all, and also refuse to allow Israel to speak in their name. They don't want to be complicit in the crimes of Israel against the Palestinians.
The American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, is another powerful entity pressuring Washington to pursue Israeli interests. Since money is what fuels American support for Israel, the pro-Israel lobbying behemoth has too much sway over American policy.
To advocate, to affect policy, for the security of the Jewish state, for the benefit of the United States, for today, for tomorrow, forever. We are AIPAC, proud pro-Israel Americans, bringing Democrats and Republicans together, citizen activists, strengthening two great nations, moving America and Israel forward together. AIPAC, America's pro-Israel lobby.
Founded more than 50 years ago to strengthen, protect, and promote the U.S.-Israel relationship, the Israeli lobby in the U.S. also makes sure that dissenting voices are not allowed to be heard by being branded as anti-Semitic. With the organization's strong encouragement, AIPAC's members keep endorsing or raising money to influence U.S. politics in favor of Israel. So what is AIPAC after in the U.S. political system?
AIPAC lobby in Washington, D.C., that continues to basically support the idea that Israel is somehow an ally to the United States because they share the same values, because it's a Judeo-Christian society. And as we know, that's all hogwash. Their main interest is, the United States' main interest is basically to have hegemony in the region and to dominate and to have their military powers inside the Middle East, you know, inside occupied Palestine. This way, it's part of their global domination period.
The main victims of Israel's vicious actions are indeed Palestinians. Decades of systematic crackdown by the occupying forces have taught Palestinian generations that resistance remains the sole method to nullify the regime's inhumane tactics.
Daily life under occupation has yielded a whole lot of troubles for the Palestinian people, which they have to deal with on a daily basis, while their sufferings are underreported. Many activists assert that it is time to pay more attention to resistance against the occupation of Palestine if the world is actually serious about ending the Israeli aggression in the region. Is there no two-state solution then?
Palestinians do not necessarily support what is called the two-state solution, nor is the two-state solution viable. It's not even viable. I mean, even if you want to say this is what you want, there isn't, it doesn't really work. Israel has continued to take on more land and Ethiopia. The other thing is that I think it's really important to understand that Palestinians as a colonized, marginalized, oppressed people should not have to have the responsibility to find solutions for the colonial power that's oppressing them. So on all counts, this is not what Palestinians want. This has been, Israel actually has consistently destroyed any possibilities. The United States has supported Israel.
One of the most brutal and obviously illegal actions that Israel has been taking is the construction of settlements in Palestinian lands. Thousands of Israelis live in settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem outputs. This is while all Israeli settlements are illegal under international law as they're built on occupied land.
We have a terrorist haven that is getting more and more rockets shipped Iran and elsewhere.
Nick, what are your thoughts on how that played out during
the... Well, that exchange, the full Israel-Palestinian exchange is, I thought, by far the most interesting moment of the debate. They actually, it calmed down. They sort of talked to each other a little bit more. And Bernie Sanders laid out pretty clearly a position I have not seen any politician lay out on national stage ever, which is to say, look, there is a conflict, and really our sympathies have to be a heck of a lot more with the Palestinians.
The international community has repeatedly opposed Israel's settlement activities, urging U.S. President Biden to put pressure on Israel over the issue. In the meanwhile, Israel keeps approving plans for more settler homes. Is it wishful thinking to somehow expect U.S. policymakers to make a positive change?
I mean, we would like to see change through Congress in the United States. We would like to see, mainstream politics go ahead and leaders getting involved. We would love that. We would love for there to be a real workable solution where the refugees can come back under UN Resolution 194, which grants the Palestinian refugees all around the world the right to return to their homes. Okay, that's my main activism here in the United States, is to push for that. But in all reality, what I see is that this illegal Zionist entity is heading towards self-destruction. Unfortunately, they venture and some of these maneuvers that will one day, end the Zionist program in Palestine.
Many in the United States question the levels of aid and general commitment to Israel. But those behind the curtain feel confident that the U.S. relations with Israel strengthen the U.S. presence in West Asia. But according to some polls, the nation is relatively divided about Washington's policies towards Tel Aviv.
They do not believe that there should be a constant incitement by Hamas, aided and abetted by Iran, against Israel.
I don't think that anybody would suggest that Israel invites or welcomes missiles flying into their country. That is not the issue. And you evaded the answer. You evaded the question. The question is not does Israel have a right to respond, not does Israel have a right to go after terrorists and destroy terrorism. That's not the debate. Was their response disproportionate? I believe that it was. You have not answered that.
Israel is more popular among older Americans, Republicans, conservatives, and evangelicals, and less popular among liberals, African Americans, and Democrats. Regardless of its public image in the US, Israel has an immense economic power with more companies listed on the NASDAQ than any other country outside North America. Is it any different with Democrats in power today?
I think the only way the new President Biden's administration is as far as occupied Palestine goes is lip service. The Democrats are better at deceiving the world. They're better at deceiving their own citizens by offering lip service about Palestine. Saying we want to get back to the table, we want to do this, and we want to... So, in other words, getting back to the table is still the same situation, it's still the same policy, because going back to the table is just delaying time, for the Palestinian people. There's an occupation that needs to end. The settlements must be dismantled. There's a long list of Palestinian refugees, as you know, languishing all over the world. Over 7.2 internally and externally million Palestinians, 7.2 million, who wish to go back to their original towns and homelands in Palestine. I happen to be one of them in the United States.
The Zionist regime was emboldened to new heights during the administration of former President Trump. The billionaire businessman, who was controlled in part by the Christian Zionists and the Jewish lobby in America, served Tel Aviv like no U.S. presidents before him. He moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem al-Quds, a holy city that Palestinians consider the capital of their future state.
It is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Israel is a sovereign nation with the right, like every other sovereign nation, to determine its own capital. It was 70 years ago that the United States, under President Truman, recognized the State of Israel. Ever since then, Israel has made its capital in the city of Jerusalem.
Unlike former presidents, Trump recognized the city as the Israeli capital, despite international outcry. The U.S. moved on and officially recognized Syria's Golan Heights to the regime's territory as well, although it had already been occupied for many years.
The United States is an interventionist power. The United States is very much interested in continuing to be intervening in the region. In that sense, Israel actually is quite the relationship with Israel. And I wouldn't say that the United States is sort of like the Israel is not only a base for the U.S., Israel is a junior partner. They both want to control the oil of the region. They want to control the region, which is a very strategic place. They want to be able to suppress any kind of possibilities for movements. They already participated both in Arab regimes, support for the counter-revolutions in the Arab world.
Many thanks. Stay with us as we have more for you.
The administration under President Joe Biden has pledged to change course in the Israel-Palestinian conflict. During his 2020 presidential election campaign, Biden reiterated his proclivity for a so-called two-state solution. The U.S.-Israel relations have also been at odds, at least on the surface, over the Biden administration's stated efforts to return Washington to the Iran nuclear deal, which Trump quit.
Remember here, Biden is very pro-Israel. I don't think that we can, you know, sugarcoat the reality that although there was a very tense relationship between Netanyahu and Obama, Biden has always had a very good relationship with the Israelis and with Netanyahu, generally speaking. That's not going to be reversed. And frankly, I'm sure there may be some elements of the progressive party of the Democrats who want to see that reversed. But the majority of the Senate will be Republican, and I think there's just no appetite to do something like reversing the embassy decision. On the JCPOA, I think there is definitely going to be an interest to go back to some sort of multilateral negotiations, which the JCPOA was. The challenge, of course, is that the world isn't the same as it was when it was negotiated in 2015.
In reality, Biden is being similarly controlled by the regime's powerful lobbies pursuing the Zionist agenda inside the United States. The pro-Israel U.S. media at times portrays Biden's relations with Israel as less cozy compared to previous American leaders. But his administration intends to build on some of Trump's one-sided policies in the region. Unlike Barack Obama and Donald Trump, Biden has not named a special envoy to focus on the Israeli-Palestinian portfolio.
Hundreds of delegates to the Democratic National Convention have asked Biden to get rid of a few pro-Israeli strategic people on his staff for his campaign, and Blinken was one of them. So that's one thing. The secondly is that Biden has also said that they're going to continue the same U.S. policy towards Israel by centering what they call Israeli security without actually giving any attention to Palestinian security, Palestinian safety. Palestinians are the ones who are occupied, who are colonized, who are displaced, who are uprooted. They are the ones who need security. It's not Israel who's like, what, the fourth or the fifth strongest army in the world. It doesn't really need that. Israel presents the argument for security in order to deflect from the real issues at stake, which is Israel's racism, colonialism, occupation, the displacement of Palestinians, the refusal to allow Palestinians to return. So now the United States government says that this is what they support. These are one of the main anchors of their policy towards Israel. They have restored some of the things that Trump taken away. So they restored U.S. funding towards UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Work Agency.
Biden has so far adopted a passive role in dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, unlike most of his recent predecessors. He has no plans for any sort of peace conference or even a peace process anytime soon. Yet, his initial resistance in engaging with the issue could eventually change, making him unable to totally ignore it.
Look, you're all united. We're all united by our unyielding, and I mean it literally, unyielding commitment to the survival, security, and success of the Jewish state of Israel. But what impresses me most is what I know those of you who've been with AIPAC a long while understand is the lifeblood and the certainty and security. And that is the more than 4,000 young people you have here. Would all the young people who are here stand up if it's your first? I want to see.
That was the former vice president. With Biden in the White House again, Trump's heavily pro-Israel tilt has been replaced with reluctance to wade into the conflict for now.
Even if the U.S. shows more interest in dealing with conflict, Palestinians have already lost their hope and trust in the United States' baseless claims of pursuing peace. It is therefore unlikely for the U.S. to change course in regards to Israel and its atrocities. I'm your host, Mila Jawamardi.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hassan Al-Tayyeb, the legislative manager for West Asia Policy at the Friends Committee on National Legislation Lobbying Group, said in a tweet, the admission by the Department of Defense that U.S. companies are still authorized to maintain Saudi warplanes means that the Biden administration is still enabling the Saudi operations in Yemen, including bombings and enforcing a blockade on Yemeni ports. I prepare for you an article written by Caitlin Johnson, an independent journalist based in Melbourne, Australia. The piece is titled, Biden Lied About Yemen as U.S. Continues to Support Saudi-Led War. Stay with us for more of Caitlin Johnson's article. The Joe Biden administration has finally admitted that the United States is indeed providing offensive material support to Saudi Arabia's genocidal assault on Yemen, directly contradicting Joe Biden's February claim that it would no longer be providing offensive support in the war. American people are being lied about. Yet another U.S. war by yet another U.S. president. Pentagon spokesman Jessica McNulty has informed Vox reporter Alex Ward, the United States continues to provide maintenance support to Saudi Arabia's Air Force, given the critical role it plays in Saudi air defense and our long-standing security partnership. Alex Ward reported, multiple U.S. defense officials and experts acknowledge that, though a U.S. government process, the Saudi government pays commercial contractors to maintain and service their aircraft, and those contractors keep Saudi warplanes in the air. However, what the Saudis do with those fighter jets is up to them, adding, the United States could cancel those contracts at any time, thus effectively grounding the Saudi Air Force, but doing so would risk losing Riyadh as a key regional partner. Hassan al-Tayeb, the legislative manager for West Asia Policy at the Friends Committee on National Legislation Lobbying Group, said in a tweet, the admission by the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, that the U.S. companies are still authorized to maintain Saudi warplanes means that the Biden administration is still enabling the Saudi operations in the war in Yemen, including bombings and enforced blockade on Yemeni ports. He told Vox reporter Alex Ward, the recent admission by the Department of Defense that U.S. companies and defense contractors are still authorized to maintain Saudi warplanes and fighter jets means that our government is still enabling the Saudi operations in Yemen, including bombings and enforcing a blockade on Yemeni ports. Tayeb is on record speaking out after Joe Biden's deceitful February announcement, saying this administration needs to make it abundantly clear what it actually means by ending offensive support for the illegal war in Yemen. He told Al Jazeera at the time, I'm not a full pessimist here. I welcome the news, adding, but I'm just trying to say to stay vigilant and not take the foot off the gas on advocacy pressure, because we don't know what's going to happen. Well, now we do know. The US is maintaining and servicing the warplanes that are bombing Yemen and enforcing a blockade which has martyred hundreds of thousands of innocent Yemenis, and the United Nations warning that a further 400,000 more could be killed this year alone if conditions don't change in the country, proving that Joe Biden is a liar and vindicating the experts and activists who cautioned against accepting Biden's announcement on blind faith. Getting to this point where questions are finally answered about the reality of the Biden administration's Yemen policy has been like pulling teeth, with officials giving questionnaires the runaround for months on this issue. Watch the clip of U.S. Yemen envoy Tim Lederking dodging questions like George Bush dodges shoes as Congressman Ted Lieu tries to get a straight answer as to whether the United States has stopped supporting the war in Yemen. Anti-war's Dave DeCamp writes, the admission comes over 2 months after President Biden claimed he was ending support for Riyadh's offensive operations in Yemen. Vox reporter Alex Ward asked Pentagon spokesman John Kirby on Monday if the planes that the United States is servicing could be used for offensive operations in Yemen. John Kirby admitted that the maintenance support for systems could be used for both offensive and defensive operations. Besides continuing to maintain the Saudi Air Force, the Biden administration has given Riyadh the political cover to continue enforcing the blockade on Yemen. Biden officials have claimed that Yemen is not under a blockade, even though Saudi warships are preventing fuel shipments from docking in the port of Hodeidah, which makes it impossible to deliver food to Yemen's starving civilian population. The United Nations conservatively estimates that some 233,000 Yemenis have been killed in the Saudi-led war, mostly from what it calls indirect causes. Those indirect causes would be disease and starvation, resulting from what United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres calls the worst famine the world has seen for decades. When people hear the word famine, they usually think of mass hunger caused by droughts or other natural disasters. But in reality, the starvation deaths we're seeing in Yemen, a huge percentage of which are children under the age of 5, are caused by something that is no more natural than the starvation deaths you'd see in medieval siege. They are the result of the Saudi coalition's use of blockades and its deliberate targeting of farms, fishing boats, marketplaces, food storage sites, and cholera treatment centers, hospitals, and clinics, with airstrikes aimed at making those parts of the country which are controlled by Yemen's Ansar Allah movement so weak and miserable that they break. The United States lies about its war with the help of mass media, but up until this year, its lies about Yemen have largely consisted of lies by omission, simply not talking about Yemen, like when MSNBC went an entire year without mentioning it a single time during the height of Russiagate hysteria, reporting on the famine as though it's the result of a tragic natural disaster, or omitting America's role in the slaughter which is going on in Yemen. This time, it was just a straightforward lie. Biden said the US was ending its offensive support for the Saudis, and it certainly wasn't. As we've discussed previously, when the people demand something of their government, it's a lot easier to simply tell them you're on their side and redirect them than to tell them no. Democrats are especially good at this. As awareness grows that Yemen is the single most horrifying atrocity taking place in our world today, pressure is mounting for the United States government to use its tremendous amount of leverage over Saudi Arabia to cease the human butchery. Rather than increasing that pressure by saying no, the Biden administration diffused it by falsely pretending to give in to the demands. Because the risk of losing Riyadh as a so-called key regional partner was deemed too great. And meanwhile, the slaughter continues in Yemen, unbroken from Obama to Trump and from Trump to Biden. The names change, the narratives change, but the murderous imperial war machine rolls on uninterrupted.
Midstream.
Iraqi Kurds, long accused of covert cozy ties with Zionist Israel, are watching on with amazement as Israel befriends allegedly hostile Arab countries. Normalization between Arab countries and Israel are changing the tragic realities for them. After the occupation arrived in 1948 and as Arab hostility toward constant Israeli aggression intensified, the occupying entity tried to reach out to non-Arab communities in West Asia. It found an opening with Iraq's Kurds who had a dream to separate from the central government in Baghdad. Israel then sought to provide military support to Kurds who were fighting Saddam Hussein's military campaigns in the north throughout the 1980s and the 1990s. In 2017, Israel backed a controversial independence referendum in northern Iraq, even as Erbil's allies, including the United States, opposed the vote. And now, as the Kurds watch several states normalizing with the region's historic foe Israel, they feel eager to take their relationship with Israeli intelligence and occupation forces out to the open, but they cannot do it on their own. They need Iraq to do it first, since Baghdad manages foreign policy. If an Israeli embassy opens in Baghdad tomorrow, the day after an Israeli consulate will be open in Erbil. This is what KRG officials openly say. However, the Iraqi resistance has a different opinion. Regional media reported last week that an Israeli Mossad outpost came under attack in northern Iraq Tuesday, April 13 at night, and that a senior Israeli intelligence agent was killed while several other Mossad agents were wounded. Such incidents, along with the constant attacks against U.S. occupation forces in Erbil Airport, puts leaders of the KRG at a hot spot for not being able to keep their regions away from harm's way by engaging in unholy alliances with Iraq's main foes, Israel and the U.S. By supporting Kurdish separatism, Israel hopes to steer the region in a new direction and by extension encourage other ethnic and religious groups in the region to seek to emulate the Kurdish example. By deliberately seeking to dismantle the existing multi-ethnic, multicultural, and multi-religious nation-states, Israel's quest to be recognized as a purely Jewish state would no longer be an aberration, or so it hopes. But we already know that it is not going to happen as long as the region's resistance is alive and capable. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The Kurds are fond of saying that they have no friends but the mountains. Yet one entity has pushed for their separation from both Iraq and Syria over many decades, Israel. The relationship between the two has evolved to the point where Israel is the only voice in West Asia encouraging rather than decrying the Kurdistan separation from Iraq. Netanyahu first publicly voiced support for an independent Kurdish state in June 2014 as the threat of Daesh was rising. However, that fantasy was blocked by the Iraqi resistance's elimination of Daesh, ridding the Kurdish Contras from Daesh threat. Yet Kurdish separatists still choose Israel over the resistance any day. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Laith Maruf, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Laith. Now, this is a very interesting topic here, specifically that the leaders of northern Iraq's Kurdistan regional government are always happy to receive Israeli support, given the international opposition to the Kurdish plans to disintegrate from Iraq. We have Kurdish leaders who could not openly celebrate their Israeli encouragement for fear of repercussions from the rest of Iraq, who link aspirations for Kurdish independence with the ideology of Zionism itself, which we have been seeing for the past 72 years. In what ways do you think the Kurdish separatists believe Israel can actually benefit their demands?
It's the same delusion that many before the Kurds have fallen into, and well, here we're talking about a small minority that is requesting the support of an imperialist against its own region. And we remember what happened to the indigenous tribes in Mexico when they sided, some of them, with the Spanish invaders against the Aztecs. And obviously the Spanish, as soon as we're done with the Aztecs, eliminated and ethnically cleansed those indigenous small tribes. And so it's a delusion for any person to side with imperialists against the people of his region, his or her region. And there's never been in history that this ended well. And it seems like the elite in the Kurdish people have not learned from history.
Well, the Kurdish regional government released an official statement last week on Wednesday denying certain reports that were present in the media, especially in the regional media, claiming that there were unknown forces that attacked a certain area, and which is a Mossad facility in the KRG, and it killed Israelis in northern Iraq. Now, at the same time, we have attacks on U.S. Bases all across Iraq, especially those who are stationed in Kurdistan, and now possible attacks against Mossad agents as well. What will be the result of such constant upheaval in northern Iraq that was once safer than actually Baghdad?
You see, the result will be continued fighting in the region. As long as the Kurds do not reconciliate with their surrounding, with their brothering and cousins in Iran, in Turkey, in the Arabic world, they will continue to be played by imperialists and apartheid Israel for the goals of not achieving then peace or stability or independence, but to undermine their brothers and neighbors. That's the ultimate goal that apartheid Israel is working on. That's the ultimate goal of the United States involvement in Iraq and Syria on the side of the Kurds. It is not for their betterment, it's for the detriment of everybody else around them, which means they will also, their house will be burning down with their surrounding. You look at what's happening in North Iraq right now with the ethnic cleansing of Nineveh, of the Babylonian and Assyrian and Syriac and Arab peoples of that region, and the after the invasion of ISIS and the Wahhabi Contras, and how these Kurdish Contras themselves actually, instead of after the defeat of ISIS in that region, allowing the people of the indigenous populations of that region to come back, have taken it over and included it in their fake new independent province or area of Iraq. So we have now Kurds that are encroaching on the traditional lands of Semitic people, Assyrians, Babylonian, and Arab. And this will not end well.
Well, this sort of covert relationship between both the Kurdish side and the Israeli side began when the Ba'ath Party was still in power between 1968 and 1975. Was the most where they shared intel, and even Israel gave weapons to Kurdistan to fight off at that time Saddam Hussein. But we had Mustafa Barzani, the father of the current president of the KRG, Masoud Barzani. He was leading a rebellion against the Iraqi regime at that time. Now, Israeli security and intelligence agents help the Kurds with military assistance and with also arms. What benefits Israel from this relationship? Obviously, other than having a foot inside of Iraq, what can they benefit from a disintegrated region?
You see, the goal of apartheid Israel in the Western Asia and North Africa, one of their main goals since the creation of Zionism, is to cut off the rivers that feed the Arab people. We're here talking about the Euphrates and the Tigris and the Nile. And so you look at how the relationship between apartheid Israel, Turkey, and Ethiopia are very important into holding our people down. And, you know, in as we see right now in Egypt, the situation is deteriorating. You know, building this dam in Ethiopia will basically starve the people of Egypt. And here is the same thing happening in the Levant. The Turks built, 40-somewhat dams on the Euphrates and Tigris, and now the Kurds are coming to steal the lands that are the part of the Fertile Crescent that fed the Arab and the Semitic people for 40,000 years, the land between the two rivers. So the aim here is to cut off the Arabic people from their ability to feed themselves, because that's one of the things that have kept the Arab people independent and able to resist imperialism and occupation for 20,000 years.
Well, given the past 10 years of war against terrorism, the region waged by the resistance against imperial powers who implanted hostile terrorists, Wahhabi-funded insurgents, and Westerns won in the region in total, especially in Iraq and in the areas controlled by the Kurds as well in northern Iraq, they suffered a lot until the Iraqi resistance led by both martyrs, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and Qasem Soleimani, went to help out, especially in Kirkuk, and rid the area of Daesh. Why is it so hard for the leaders of the KRG to accept that and to take a firm stance alongside the resistance, the Iraqi resistance, whom they share with the land, the sky, the nation, the pride?
Well, unfortunate for the Kurdish people that they are cursed with such leadership that cannot even acknowledge a favor that was done to them and the saving of the Kurdish people in Iraq from these Wahhabi Contras that would have, kidnapped and raped and all their children and women and killed their men if they were able to. So, we know that the Kurdish people is different than their elite, and their elite, unfortunately, are corrupted to the bone, where they're not their care is not about protecting their people. It's about stealing as much money as possible through the looting of the Iraqi oil, now the Syrian oil also, and taking all the money that comes in from the West and the weapons. And, you know, so you look at what's happening in Kurdistan, Iraq, and the disparity between this political elite and the people on the ground is huge. And ultimately, the hope is that there will be new movements within the Kurdish people that will, you know, push these elites out that are collaborating with imperialists.
Well, that remains to be seen as how the region is actually beginning to look like one which is waiting for fire to happen, or rather diplomacy to work throughout its sway. I want to thank you very much, Laith Ma'rouf, for being with us, political commentator in Beirut, to talk about the relationship between Israel and the Kurds of Iraq. Now, please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about how the U.S. bases in Iraq are being shot one after the other.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marbo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Another military base hosting U.S. troops in Iraq was targeted with drones carrying explosives on Wednesday morning, ending any illusions that President Joe Biden's strike on Iraqi resistance soldiers inside Syria would deter such retaliatory attacks. Now, no casualties were reported in the attack on the airport in Erbil, which doubles as a base for U.S. troops. Now, before U.S. occupation troops shook off the Erbil attack, another one hit them on Friday in the Ain al-Assad base located in the Anbar governorate of western Iraq. U.S. occupation bases under heavy fire across Iraq in this following report.
Renewed drone attacks on U.S. targets in Iraq show that the Iraqi resistance is keen on ridding its nation from U.S. occupation, as U.S. pressure on the government in Baghdad is heaping, while Biden seeks leverage over the Iraqi official decision to see the U.S. leave their country once and for all. Iraq, scarred by decades of U.S. invasion, war, and Western-backed terrorism, has been a strategic location for the U.S. occupation to face off with its main foe, Iran, while making sure that the Iraqi popular choice of resistance be suppressed. The resumption of retaliatory attacks against U.S. occupation bases in Iraq shows that the Iraqi resistance are now abandoning de-escalation and seeking leverage over their rivals. It seems we're back to last year when, for several months in 2020, rockets rained down on American sites once a week or more. However, this time, not only in Anbar or Baghdad, but also in northern Iraq's Kurdistan region. A drone dropped explosives targeting U.S. occupation forces stationed at Erbil Airport in northern Iraq late on Wednesday, April 14, with no reports of casualties. However, a separate rocket attack killed a Turkish soldier at a military base nearby. It was the first known attack carried out by an unmanned aerial drone against U.S. forces in Erbil, amid a steady stream of rocket attacks on bases hosting U.S. occupation forces and their embassy in Baghdad that Washington blames on what it calls Iran-backed militias. The U.S. still cannot fathom the thought that Iraqis have every right to defend their land, especially after their tragic history of the American invasion, occupation, theft, and embedding Takfiri terrorism. Shortly before Wednesday's attack in Erbil, at least two rockets landed on a base to the west of the city that hosts Turkish forces, killing a Turkish soldier. Turkey also has troops in Iraq, both as part of a NATO contingent and a force that has attacked Kurdish separatist militants in the north. The Iraqi resistance had already expressed its opposition to the presence of the United States and Turkey and demand a full withdrawal of all foreign troops. But since all their words went unheard, they sought a louder form of expression, which definitely got the attention of all foreign occupation forces in Iraq.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Malmo is Firas Ali, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Firas. Now, Iraqi resistance factions have upped the stakes with drone attacks against U.S. occupation forces inside of Iraq, a technique which is actually favored elsewhere in West Asia, and it seems to be affordable, yet very accurate and very effective. Are we at a crossroad for the U.S. illegal presence in Iraq, or maybe is this the storm before the actual big explosion that might happen?
The Iraqi resistance has chosen a very strategic offensive against the U.S. occupation. This choice is very accurate and it doesn't risk Iraqi civilians' lives, neither through their own action or through rough and disproportionate reactions from the U.S. occupation. It's enough headache and damage for the civilian Iraqis that their lives are endangered by the U.S. missile defense, air missile defense system that they use around the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. Because usually, and it's very often actually, that shrapnels from that missile defense system drops down on civilian houses and damages it. The Iraqi resistance are therefore slowly choking the occupation, and this will make them bleed to death. A big explosion could occur if the Americans make a stupid mistake, like, for example, a bigger operation against the resistance. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't seem to be in the planning, at least not openly. I think the Americans would instead certainly prefer pushing Iraqi security forces against the resistance, and thus both having an internal fight and getting a pause from the attacks. Hopefully that won't happen.
Well, Firas, the U.S. has been planning to leave Baghdad, especially the green zone in Baghdad, and move north towards Erbil, away from the constant attacks by certain Iraqi groups that don't really name themselves or give a bit of a vague name for themselves. Yet they now find themselves being attacked, and people are following them up there and attacking them because they are not welcome in Iraq. What are the U.S. options when it comes to dealing with such specific drone attacks?
The Americans have only one option on. Let's make use of their favorite phrase, as we got to use it. Although it was a long time that they used it themselves, they used to say that all options are on the table. I think the Iraqi resistance are telling the Americans now, you have only one option on the table, and that's leaving Iraq. It doesn't matter where in Iraq you move, we will follow you there. If they don't leave Iraq, they will have to face the consequences. As you mentioned, we've seen in the region, and especially in the U.S.-backed Saudi war on Yemen, the U.S. defense system can't protect the kingdom from this kind of kamikaze drones, regardless of how expensive or the state of the art they are. This is actually making the Americans very irritated. Expensive defense system can't protect them against cheap but effective drones. Mm-hmm. And the use of drones are probably even safer for the Iraqi resistance than missiles, because they can send them from a distance without a bigger security setup, and they don't leave any traces.
Well, politically, the U.S. keeps poking at the Iraqi government, at Qadhimi's government, after every attack it faces inside of Iraqi territories, despite the fact that the Iraqi parliament considers the Iraqi resistance part of the Iraqi army since 2017. And so basically, when the U.S. targets the Iraqi resistance, it is basically targeting the Iraqi army itself. Where does Qadhimi's government stand on this very crucial matter?
Well, it seems that the interim government of Qadhimi are trying to balance between the occupation and the request of the parliament, which in fact is the wish of the Iraqi people. The government is actually engaged in a dialogue with the representatives of the United States of America in Iraq. They're talking about a withdrawal, but regardless, the Iraqi people are receiving mixed signals. The interim government said that the troops will leave, but spokesman for the occupation army says another thing. Sometimes they're talking about moving north to northern Iraq, and sometimes you can hear the Secretary General of NATO saying that they will replace the U.S. occupation. So it's hard to know who is the honest guy here in the room. But U.S. forces have decreased in Iraq, and that's a fact. But I don't think it's because of the dialogue. I think it's because of the security concerns they have amid the ongoing attacks.
Well,
but that's not enough.
But Firas, we have seen once again that the Iraqi file is pressing the Biden administration to make some sort of a firm stance towards its presence, its troops' presence inside of Iraq. It's illegal. presence inside of Iraq. But Biden seems preoccupied these days, maybe with internal affairs or rather with Iranian JCPOA agreements that are going on or negotiations that are underway in Vienna as well. Can it be that the Iraqi events are also tied from an American point of view? They are tied to the Iranian deal as it is being propagated by the Western mainstream media that propagates everything that goes on in the White House.
I personally don't think that. It's true that Iran has evolved to a regional power, but it's far-fetched to attach everything in the region to the Iranian nuclear file. They say this every time there's an issue in the region, regardless of it, if it's about Lebanon, Yemen, or Iraq. But it's far from true. Unlike USA, Iran have allies which are connected to it ideologically, but they are very independent. Thus, they are acting with this independence, and that's why the Iraqi file is not connected at all to the nuclear file, the Iranian nuclear file. Mm-hmm. And the United States will sooner or later